you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. What you're about to hear is part three, the finale of The Isle of the Lost by Kevin Valbenesi. If you haven't done so already, I'd recommend you go back and start with part one, so this makes more sense. If you're not familiar with the Twilight Histories format, in these stories you are the adventurer, just like in a game book or role-playing campaign. You will travel to different dimensions and experience strange and exotic cultures that never existed in our timeline, all with you as the hero. Before we start, I'd like to recommend you listen to Historical Blindness. Have a listen to this.
Mysteries, hoaxes, folklore, conspiracy, and pseudo-history. Topics sometimes avoided by historians who don't want to normalize nonsense or draw attention to the blind spots in our knowledge of the past. But these are some of our most intriguing tales. The Lost Colony of Roanoke, The Man in the Iron Mask, The Princes in the Tower, The Battle of Los Angeles, The Turin Shroud. Stories like these, fraught with ambiguities and falsehoods and suggesting alternate views of history, not only entertain but also teach us to view the past and the present with a critical eye. Join me, Nathaniel Lloyd, as I delve into these stories on my podcast, Historical Blindness, and shine a light in the darker corners of the past. New episodes every other Tuesday, available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and most podcast apps.
That's Historical Blindness. Go check it out. And now, on to today's show, The Isle of the Lost, Part 3, by Kevin Valbenesi.
Rage is like the magma flowing from Earth's fiery heart until it erupts forth, incinerating and rolling over everything in its path. And like a slumbering volcano, the wrath of the sleeping ancients has burst forth, painting the walls of the sacred temple with a crimson hue. Sanguine streams crisscross the floor, crawling along like little rivers of lava. The dead are everywhere. Turkish soldiers lay crumpled over, some run through with long spears, others laying flat on their backs, glassy eyes gazing up at the ceiling. A few Germans are here as well, laying face down in pools of their own blood. And the others are here too. You recognize the large, muscular bodies, olive skin and ruddy hair. These warriors lay where they fell, their simple robes dotted with bullet holes. Some still grasp at their spears, as if to continue the struggle into the afterlife. Others lay next to rusty circular shields. Despite all their modern advantages, the Germans and Turks clearly met a capable enemy. That most of the downed others have several gunshot wounds is not lost on you. It clearly took more than a single round to fell these giants. Death for modern combatants was swift. The spears, rusted as they are, could still disembowel a man with sufficient force, and you have no doubt that the others could supply such force. Tempting as it may be to pick up a spear and plunge into the dark depths, you much prefer your chances with a pistol in hand. Taking a moment, you relieve dead Turkish soldiers of their weapons. Bullets are in short supply, so you tuck a pistol into every available pocket and keep one in hand. You won't be caught flat-footed down there. Not if you can help it. You leave the dead and make for the doorway which leads to that eon-dead vault. Stopping at the threshold, You listen keenly and hear the subtle pop of gunfire down below. It should be louder, especially in so reverberant a chamber. But at least it means that the battle rages on, and you may have the cover you need to spirit Cromwell away from this whole mess. The lights are still working, if just. You level the pistol in your hand and descend into the depths. You take every step slowly, cautiously. Blood is everywhere, and it makes getting firm footing a task. And there are bodies here, too, fallen and tangled up in unnatural ways after what must have been a fall and a tumble. You don't want to end up with a shattered spine either, so you move with great attention to detail. You keep your pistol pointed ahead and down at an angle, expecting someone to emerge from down below. You use your free hand to brace yourself against the walls when required. It's slow going, but the constant peppering of gunfire up ahead assures you that haste will have you joining the ranks of the dead and decomposing here in the bowels of the earth. Your patience pays off, and you find yourself once more in that antechamber where the great seal had once frustrated you. Now the way is open, and once again, the interior beyond is dark, with only the faintest light of dying lanterns to show you the way. You wonder about the many cases which had laid there, unopened, their residence dormant. How many had stirred to fight the strange invaders? Could there be any just waking now and ready to pounce after their long rest? You take a pistol from your other pocket, wielding the weapons akimbo. Anything to even the odds. You steady yourself, taking a deep breath. Level your guns and inch forward, one step at a time, praying that the specters who haunt these halls will give you safe passage. You penetrate the almost material darkness, guns ready, heart racing faster than any bullet. You slosh through the ankle-deep liquid spilled out of so many now-empty cases. As with the steps, your progress is painfully slow. You lean over cases, half expecting the undying denizens of this chamber to leap out. Strange glass lays against many of the cases, but more often than not, it's hiding under the liquid, causing you to lose your footing. You can hardly see 10 feet in front of you, and with potentially dozens of angry ancients waiting in the shadows, you don't want to tread any slower than you already are. The further along you get, the more reason you have to go slowly. Now, you can add corpses to your list of things trying to trip you up. Turks and ancients lay half submerged in the mysterious liquid, their blood mixing with it, turning its milky hue into something rosy. There's another crackle of gunfire, and you startle, nearly falling into an open case. You drop one of your pistols, and you whinge in pain, your hands searching around. But eventually, you resign yourself to the loss of that precious weapon. You find a rifle jutting out from under the body of a dead Turkish soldier, but you doubt it's going to fire now. You right yourself and pull out your remaining pistol, searching around for the source of the gunfire. You hear it again, and it seems to be coming from the direction you were heading, on the far side where the priestess's case was discovered. But the shots sound too distant. Your ears should be ringing if anyone fired in this chamber. You level your guns and proceed slowly, expecting to find yourself on top of the combatants. You whisper, "Cromwell! Dr. Cromwell!" No response. Of course not. keep going until you find yourself in front of the plinth upon which the priestess's case once rested. There's nothing here. No soldiers. No Dr. Cromwell. Nothing but corpses. And then you hear something. There's a trickle, as if from some puny stream. You look down, and you can see the ruddy streaks of blood flowing forward. You crouch down and creep along, following the blood until you find the source of the trickling. There's an opening here. You're certain you didn't see it before, but there it is. It's rectangular in shape and appears perfectly cut out of the rock. Glancing ahead, you see that it leads to another staircase. This one, quite tight. You level your pistols again and peer into the darkness. Nothing. At least, not as far as you can see. More gunfire. And this time, it's louder. Closer. It's coming from down there. Cromwell! You whisper down into the shadows. Again, nothing. You wonder if one of the many bodies behind you is his, but somehow you doubt a thorough search will turn anything up. No, you're sure he went down there if he could, content to pursue some further discovery with total disregard for the peril all around him. It's not like you're any better. Sure, you want to save the old man, but that can't be the only thing pushing you onward into the bowels of the earth, where the undead roam about, spearing anyone who trespasses here. Whatever it is that's keeping you going compels you to descend the steps. You're on your way before you know it. You pocket one of the pistols, needing your free hand to feel about in the darkness. Not long into your descent, the light ceases to penetrate from the chamber behind you, and every step you take becomes a tense negotiation. The trickling fluid underneath your feet makes your descent a slippery one, and eventually, you're forced to pocket your other gun and use both hands to steady yourself against the wall. You continue on like this for longer than anyone might reasonably expect. Whether it's 10 minutes or an hour, you cannot know. The only thing helping to mark the passage of time is the sporadic gunfire coming from somewhere ahead of you. But even the sounds of combat become few and far between. Someone, you think, must be getting the upper hand. And soon, the winning faction will turn their attention to you and your lost patriarch. Then, you notice something. That you notice anything at all is a miracle here in the void. It's light. Faint. Diffuse. But unmistakably, it's light. The hue is curious. A mix of blue-green shades. Still, it affords you some hope. And so you quicken your pace a little. While completely exposed to any hidden enemy, you do find that you're suddenly making good progress. And soon enough, the light is concentrated enough that you can see the exit from the staircase. You splash down onto a landing and find yourself confronted by the fierce aspect of a subterranean deity. You stumble back, drawing one of your pistols. But you realize that it's only a stony gaze that greets you. The contours of the thing give up its anthropoid nature immediately. You recognize the solid physique and the flowing robes of the mariners. But the head, well, that's more of a bestial cast. A bull's head crowns the statue, with two large horns protruding outward. You notice that this bull also has a thick beard, like that of a Grecian hero. But The style of the thing has a distinctly Eastern cast to it. The pose is like that of an Egyptian pharaoh or some monument of Ashurbanipal. The eyes are almond-shaped and made from rubies set into stone, framed with golden eyelids. The thing extends an open palm toward you, as if to order a halt, while the other arm gestures off to the side. Your eyes trace the suggestion offered by the silent sentinel, and they find yet another opening, though this one is to a roughly level corridor. Now you see where the light was coming from. Thick mats of an algae or lichen of some kind radiate that familiar aquamarine tint. This bioluminescent growth emerges from curiously regular channels in the rock. You even notice some growing behind and around the statue. The whole thing gives a soft glow and makes the air seem almost material. More gunfire snaps you out of your momentary reverie, returning your mind to the task at hand. If Cromwell came this way, he must be ahead, wherever that corridor leads. You crouch down near the opening and discover that the inky black floor is actually water, given away by subtle ripples in its surface. Then you notice tiny cracks from which issue forth modest trickles of water. The Pontus Euxinus never ceased its assault on the sunken city. And now, the tectonic forces which thrust its crown above the waves have exposed its soft underbelly to pressure exerted by that vast body of water. The whole thing might come down on you at any moment, or a wall could burst and drown you here. If you're going to pursue Cromwell further, you know you'll have to move quickly, and that might hurl you straight into a spear or into the barrel of a rifle. You draw both your pistols, and, accepting the challenge of the antediluvian minotaur, you step down into the waterlogged labyrinth. Hell is not hot. It's cold, damp, and musty. The builders of this vicious subterranean world knew well how to confound any alien visitor. This is a maze. Of that, you have no doubt. You've passed the same corpse floating in the water 3 times now. The linear corridor opened up onto branching paths, all looking equally gloomy and in danger of imminent collapse. The constant trickling of water from the tiny fissures only adds to the monotony of your journey. And at this rate, you fear you may go mad. Still, you press on, wading through waist-deep water, keeping your guns ready and listening keenly for the sounds of others wandering the labyrinth. You've heard no gunfire for an unbearably long time. And that means that the victors can now roam at ease. Turks, Germans, or ancients. None of them would be a sight for sore eyes now. Growing frustrated at your lack of progress, you decide on a novel innovation. You need the equivalent of Ariadne's thread. The best you can manage is scraping away some of the luminous moss, leaving little dark crosshatches to mark where you've been. Of course, the observant among your foes may notice this as well, but you're loath to be trapped here with them, and doomed to run in circles. After a bit of trial and error, you come across some more corridors barren of your little wayfinders. But as you make progress, you come across more bodies, all floating in the water. In one corridor, you have to clamber over a mound of the dead, representing both sides of the conflict. Again, You have to mind your footing as you stumble on rifles and spears hiding under the water. And if you drop your pistols now, doom is certain. Up ahead, you hear someone sloshing around in the water. More than one person, in fact. You freeze and crouch down as much as you can, keeping your arms and head above water. The corpse of a dead German floats nearby, and you scoot over to it, careful not to disturb the water too much. Whoever's out there knows they aren't alone. You can hear the splashing getting louder and louder. You hide behind the corpse and rest your elbows on it, using it as a platform to steady your aim. You wait with bated breath, not even daring to blink. Your arms, despite the impromptu support, tremble. Two hulking forms come around the corner, both wielding a spear and shield. You don't even wait. You just unload onto them. One of them catches a bullet in the throat and collapses into the water, gurgling as he goes. The other takes a shot to the shoulder, but enraged, lifts his shield and advances on you. You explode up from your position and fire, but the shield deadens your bullets. You scramble back, tossing aside one pistol as it fails to fire. You double back onto the mound of corpses and hurl yourself onto it, scrambling up and over it. Your feet go out from under you, swept aside by the hard edge of the ancient shield. You roll over and see the ancient, murder in his eyes, lifting his spear up as he's about to strike. He thrusts the point down and you roll to the side. The blade catches you, grazing your arm, tearing it open with its rusty edge. The warrior lands on top of you, pressing his mammoth bulk into you. Still holding your remaining pistol, you try to wiggle it out from under his gut, and the moment presents itself when he heaves up to strike at you again. You whip your arm up and pop a round off into the bottom of the man's jaw. He dies instantly, collapsing onto you, smothering you against the pile of corpses. Water rushes in, and you frantically shake and struggle to avoid being drowned. You find your opening and slip out, gasping for air as you do. You clamber up and aim around wildly with your pistol, half expecting more assailants to come running. You stay like that for minutes, but nobody comes. Only after a little while do you remember the searing pain in your left arm. You collapse against the wall, and thinking quickly, you pocket your pistol, tear a strip of cloth from your shirt, and tie it around the open wound. It's the best you can do. You're quick to take your pistol back out, and you keep it pointed ahead as you suck in air and try to regain some measure of composure. Finally, you get on the move again, prompted by the fact that the water is now up to your chest. You press on, taking precious moments to mark your way. Getting turned around now might get you drowned. You notice your pace is slowing again, perhaps because of blood loss, or perhaps because the water all around you is getting colder and colder. You can feel the energy draining from your limbs, and you have to fight to take every step, and to keep your only means of defense dry. You begin to sway, and you have to fight like hell just to stay on your feet. You don't have long at this point, so you brace yourself against the walls, pushing onward, more and more, fighting for every inch. You come stumbling around a corner, and you trip on something under the water. Your pistol flies from your hand, and you crash into the water. And as you plunge under the inky blackness, you try to summon what little strength you have left. You kick and flail your arms in every direction. You thrash about until one hand slams into a horizontal piece of stone. And clambering wildly, you grasp at the stone with both hands and pull yourself forward. Reaching out again, you find another bit of stone, this one a little higher up. You pull yourself forward, finding another and another stone, one slightly above the other. Your legs stop moving, leaving you with what little strength you have to drag yourself forward, little by little by little. You're so focused on crawling forward that you don't notice the darkness creeping in from the corners of your eyes until it overwhelms you completely. A cold streak shocks you awake. You flounder on cold stone, scrambling away from creeping water, clambering up on steps until your hand comes to rest on something cold and metallic. You wrap your fingers around a pistol, your pistol, and looking up past it, you see there's a small flight of stairs leading up into another chamber. You heave yourself up and come to rest on the landing. Glancing back down, you can see that the water has risen to where your head might be. No going back now. You curl up into a ball and rub your chest, trying to restore vigor to your frigid core and limbs. You pull your shirt off and wring it out before putting it back on. It's not doing you much good, but whatever comfort you can have now is worth the effort. With great difficulty, you get to your feet and check your gun. There's a single round left in the clip. One shot for whatever awaits you beyond. Or, perhaps, for yourself. You pop the clip back in and step forward, entering another corridor lined with luminous moss. You lumber on, propping yourself up against the wall with your free hand. Your ears are ringing, but in time, this gives way to something else. Persistent sound somewhere up ahead. You hear clicking, grinding, and locking. It's the sound of some great assembly line in this impossibly ancient cavern. So discordant with your situation is the sound that you forget your pain and press on, hurrying to confront whatever mystery awaits you. Emerging out from the corridor, you find yourself in another vast chamber. But unlike the vault you first stumbled upon, this one is so well lit that it's almost blinding. The moss here is omnipresent, clinging to the walls and even the floors. You find yourself at a lower landing, a short flight of steps leading up to some raised platform. Looking up, you can see the top of something metallic, and you hear that clicking, grinding, and locking. Your feet are in motion before you know it, but a hand shoots out and grabs you. You flinch, turn, and point your pistol at your assailant, but you stop short of pulling the trigger when you find the aged face of Dr. Cromwell looking at you with manic eyes. He raises a finger to his lips and leads you up the steps, slowly, carefully, stopping short of halfway to the upper level. The old man forces you to crouch down, and you understand why. Up ahead, you see the priestess, hurrying about in her own fit of mania, trying to make sense of the mechanical impossibility which takes center stage in the chamber. An intricate, interlocking, overlapping mess of rings, spheres, and gears. It's all cast in gold, and it moves slowly, deliberately. Great bejeweled spheres move about the interior cage of this device. 9 of them, to be exact. They knew. The ancients gazed upon the stars like we do now. They understood the motion of the heavenly bodies when our ancestors were hiding among the trees of Europe, struggling to fend off wolves. Babylon, Memphis, and Athens never wrought such genius. No, they were all pale imitations. Congratulations on your discovery. It only cost us our lives. No, dear friend. We shall return to the world above and humble the world with the brilliance of our discovery. The way we came is flooded. The ceiling might cave in any minute. This island is going to sink back down to where it came from and take us all with it. Cromwell becomes extremely distressed, tearing at his hair. You see the pistol in his hand, your old pistol. And he puts the muzzle dangerously close to his temple. I must know more. I won't die with questions. Dr. Cromwell, what are you talking about? Cromwell explodes up, rushing onto the platform. You rush out after him, and it's then that the priestess comes from around the machine, reading curious glyphs in its base before spotting you and the doctor. She fixes her cold eyes on you, and her body tenses up. We mean no harm, my dear. We are scientists, like you. We've come here to understand. Cromwell creeps towards the woman, arms outstretched. She stands her ground, and in a flash, you see her pull a small dagger from within the folds of her robes. Before you can train your gun on her, she lunges forward and runs Cromwell through with the dagger. He's dead before he hits the floor. The priestess withdraws her dagger from the limp body of the old man and prepares to lunge at you. You level your weapon at her, and she pauses. You see a flash of understanding in her eyes. She knows what your modern weapons can do, so she slowly backs off, keeping the dagger between you and her, signaling that this is anything but surrender. She opens her mouth and speaks, but it's gibberish to you. At least, it is at first. Your translator works overtime, and in the mad ramblings of the priestess, you recognize a few familiar sounds.
Erni. Too early. Destroyed. Too soon. You.
Her hand tightens around her dagger. I'm sorry. We found this place by accident. We didn't mean any harm. She tilts her head, trying to work out what you're saying. Her face tenses up, and she walks toward you, dagger pointed straight ahead. I don't want to kill you, but I will. An intense rumble precedes a rush of water, and you glance back to see a surge of water erupting from where you came. You turn back and find the priestess tossing her dagger aside. She collapses to her knees and begins to weep.
Ruined. Destroyed. Too soon.
She howls, striking at the ground. Large chunks of rock break free from the ceiling and come crashing down, striking the mechanical wonder behind her.
Is there a way out? A way out? Please, tell me if you know something.
all lost. Too soon.
Fire your last bullet at the ceiling and point the gun back at her. She looks up at you with glassy eyes while you fix a fiery gaze on hers. Your arms tremble as you point your pistol at her, praying that she doesn't know you can run out of ammunition. Please, I'll come back, and I'll save what I can. I won't let the world forget what you've done here. She looks at you, and her expression changes. It's something between puzzlement and understanding. You toss your pistol aside and fold your hands together, pleading. The priestess rises, and with singular focus, she strides over to a series of golden gears at the base of the machine. She turns some this way and that, others that way and this, and then she looks at you. She extends an arm, pointing to the far wall. You strain to see what she's pointing to, but a flash of gold makes it clear. You see a golden plate draw back and reveal a narrow passage carved into the rock. As the earth shakes again, you rush off, stopping only an instant to call back to the priestess. Come with me, please. She doesn't meet your eyes. Instead, she lays down, back to the machine, and curls up into a ball. As more debris crashes down in every direction, you spin on your heels and rush for the passageway, leaving the mysterious woman and her ancient technology to be entombed once more. Squeeze into the passageway, and looking up, you see a pinprick of golden light in the distance. You know that hue anywhere. It's the golden light of the morning sun. And despite the agony your body is in, you thrust yourself forward, hurrying toward that faraway light. You fight and fight to ascend every step, hoping that you'll hurl yourself out onto the sun-baked rock above. And you're not sure if you'll make it, but the chance to tell this world of all you've seen here is reason enough to try. And so you carry on, inching closer and closer to the warmth of that familiar light as the world below you comes crashing down.
What you just heard was the conclusion of The Isle of the Lost by Kevin Valbenesi. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please support The Twilight Histories by joining us on Patreon. And speaking of Patreon, our patrons have voted. You remember at the end of last show, we began to explore a very sad world where Paris was struck by an asteroid in 1908. The blast was the equivalent of a large hydrogen bomb, and it absolutely flattened the city, turning the landscape into a kind of lava-cracked Mordor. You materialized the day after the event, right near the lip of the crater. You were picked up by a fisherman who took you out of the death zone and to some hospital tents. I asked our patrons if they'd rather volunteer at the tents or join the fishermen and rescue more survivors. 35 patrons voted, and the result was unanimous. So, here we go. You've been helping the fishermen collect the wounded for a week. The most extreme cases are dead. The people you rescue now are those with lesser wounds. The great dust cloud is cleared, revealing a vast landscape of devastation. Most eerie is the River Seine, its geography disturbed by the blast. It now spreads out across the land like a shallow lake, ruins rising from it like tombstones in a mud-brown flooded cemetery. The expanding waters help you reach further inland, but they also ensure all survivors who are still buried are drowned. It's evening, and the captain docks the boat next to a hill. You need to find coal for the small boat. You follow a road through flattened gardens buried under a thick layer of soot. There are smashed houses, and you rummage through them collecting coal and food. You come to a large, ruined building. Some of its huge, ornate walls remain buttressed against the sky. "What's this?" you say. "I think it may be Versailles." You climb through the ruins. You find one of the great halls, the ceiling half caved in. It looks like a place where elegantly dressed people might once have waltzed the evening away. There are a few peasants huddled in the corner around a cooking fire. One of them has a hand organ and is playing a sad tune. You and the captain join them. Without saying a word, he pulls out a bottle of champagne he found in one of the cellars and uncorks it. It's passed around from mouth to mouth in silence. The organ stops, and the chirps of some lone cricket fill the night air, an insect's requiem to the death of Paris. The captain rises and is swallowed by the night. Your head is a little dizzy from the liquor being passed around, and you lie down and look up at the stars twinkling through the blasted ceiling. You wonder why the captain is taking so long. You pick yourself up and leave the fire, swaying a little from the drink. You find him in one of the rooms, curled up in a ball, crying. You take a curtain and drape it over him like a blanket. He takes the curtain and pulls it over his head. You leave him to his grief. It's the first time you've seen him cry. "Wake up," the captain says, nudging you with his foot. The morning sky is bright, and it hurts your eyes. Your head feels like it's cracked in places. You're hungover. It doesn't help you were sleeping on stones. "Do we have to get up?" "Yes, you are hungover. Others are injured and need our help." "Okay, you're right," you say, and rise to your feet, holding your head in your hands. "I found coal."
"Where?"
"There's a coal chute. Come." You follow the captain out of the ruins and around the side. There's a grate that's been removed from the ground, and down below you can smell the coal.
"We'll take 2 buckets each. It will be a long walk back to the boat, so don't worry about packing them too full."
You carry the buckets down the road. It doesn't take long before your arms are exhausted. You rest in the grass, which is covered in soot. The captain takes out a sausage and portions it out with a knife.
"I'm sorry for what you saw last night," he says.
"What? Oh, no, don't worry about it."
"No, I have to say it. I left because I didn't want anyone to see me."
"Right, I see. I'm sorry if I just didn't know where you were."
He stabs the knife into the ground hard, then stands and turns away. "My wife was in Paris," he says. "She was there to see her family. I was coming down to pick her up, so I saw the comet. It was as bright as the sun. It lit the sky like a fire. The blast almost sank my boat. I came down as fast as I could."
"You've been trying to find her?"
"Yes. It's hopeless, though." you notice a group of soldiers hiking down the road towards you.
"We'll keep looking," you say. "There are plenty of survivors."
"No, she's certainly gone. I was going to pick her up at the Louvre. She was more cultured than me. I don't know why she was with a common fisherman."
"You're not common. You've saved a lot of lives."
He shakes his head.
"Finding you so close to the impact, it gave me hope."
I'm sorry for that."
"You were right on the lip of the crater."
"I know. I must have been walking around for a while, gone in when I should have gone out."
"But the Seine, it goes all around the crater. The crater is an island in the middle of it. How did you get in there?"
"I really don't know. I assume I walked there before the river trapped me."
He sits down in the sooty grass and leans back on his elbows. He looks dejected. "Yes, that's probably it."
The soldiers approach. They carry large packs and they look tired. You nod at them as they pass. An officer walks up to you.
"What are you two doing lying about?"
"Just bringing coal to my boat," the captain says, motioning to the buckets.
"Don't you know there's a war to fight?"
"War? What war?"
"The Germans. They've crossed the Ardennes. Come on, get yourselves in line."
"We can't. We're looking for survivors."
"It looks to me like you're having a picnic. Now get in line."
The captain doesn't move. The officer pulls out his revolver, but points it to the ground.
"So, it will be like that," the captain says.
You hike the rest of the day and into the evening, following the banks of the Seine north. You get to know a couple of the soldiers. You're in a reservist unit from Orléans, a city not far from Paris. The soldier next to you is a young man named Jean-Baptiste. He's thin, with wisps of a mustache. You learn his father is a local bank manager in Orléans. He was studying finance in Paris on his father's orders and had to return home for the summer, mercifully avoiding the event. But he had friends who remained in Paris, as well as some family. He tells you the conflicting emotions racing through him are tearing him apart. Sadness at the loss of loved ones, relief at the avoidance of death, excitement at going to war, anger at the Kaiser for attacking France during its time of greatest need, a patriotism he never knew he had. You stop for the evening. You line up and eat a bowl of grub. Then you find a patch of grass and collapse in exhaustion. You're asleep before you can even finish eating. You're nudged awake. It's night, and you can hear crickets.
Who's that?
Shh, it's me, the captain says. Come on, let's go.
Go where?
I'm leaving. I have to keep going. I have to keep looking for my wife. Come with me.
So, will you try to escape with the captain? Or will you continue on to the front with Jean-Baptiste to fight the Germans? You get to choose. Head on over to the website and follow the link to our Patreon page. All patrons of the show will get a chance to vote. When you sign up, you get access to tons of great stuff. Depending on your level of support, you can access over 50 shows, plus early access to new shows. And there's even an option to work with me personally to create a full show based on your ideas for a world. Why are we doing this? The purpose of this Patreon area is to build the Twilight Histories into a weekly podcast by bringing in amazing storytelling podcasters to create shows for you. We've built a great team so far.
but there's still so much more we want to do. Your support through Patreon will help us get there. Please go to twilighthistories.com and click on Patreon to support the show. I'm Jordan Harbour. Until next time, take care.